At one time it said that Israel should not even exist and their land should be given over to the Palestinians. At one point she had said that. I think she's retracted it. But she argued about Israel's massacre in Gaza when Israel undergoes rocket attacks from Gaza and strikes back. And she talks about the occupation of Palestine, that this land is Palestine's land, it's not Israel's land. I won't even quote Representatives Tlaib or Omar, who are Muslims, but you don't have to be a Muslim to hate Israel or to be confused about Israel. So is Israel an usurper in the Middle East, that they don't belong there? I want to do an overview of the Old Testament with Israel in view for two reasons. One, a review of the Old Testament is always good. We need it from time to time. But secondly, there is much confusion of Israel, and I hope to clarify some things about that nation. God's program with humanity was with Israel before it was ever with us. And there are popular modern views of Israel. So I want to start at the beginning with Israel. I want to start with the book of Genesis. Genesis can be divided into two major parts. The first 11 chapters of Genesis deal with events. The creation, the fall of man, the flood with Noah and his ark, or literally box is what the word means, and then the Tower of Babel, where nations were separated because of language. But the second section of Genesis, which runs all the way from chapter 12, and we'll go there here pretty shortly, you could turn there, is people-centered. And it starts with Abraham, goes to his son Isaac, goes to his son Jacob, and then to Jacob's son, primarily a focus on his second to youngest son, Joseph. And we will look at each of those. But today I want to look at the past and future and present. It's not a typo. I have laid it out that way. We will look at Israel's past. We will look at Israel's future. And then we'll look briefly at Israel's present to answer the question, is there a place for Israel in the plan of God today? Let's begin it with a prayer. Father, open us up to understand. Guide us and direct us by your Spirit. Teach us your word. Help me, Lord God, to handle it clearly and accurately. And Father, I pray that you will clarify things in our minds, awaken us to things that we didn't know, but just teach us and change us. In Jesus' name, amen. So first off, we'll look at the past. And we'll begin in Genesis chapter 12. And I bring Abraham and Isaac together. I don't want to get into Isaac. I'll mention him. But Abraham is the beginning person with God's plan with Israel. So I want you in Genesis chapter 12. That begins this way. Now the Lord said to Abram. Later on his name was changed to Abraham. He said to Abram, he says, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse you, and the one who curses you I will curse. I think it has always been fortunate that this country has been supportive of Israel. And I use this verse, this chapter 3 of Genesis chapter 12, as a support for it. That those nations that curse Israel, God's going to curse them. There's not going to be a good outcome for those that curse Israel. And those that bless Israel, I think there'll be special favor. Now, I've got another section up here called Mistakes. And it's also in Genesis chapter 12. And Isaac makes the same mistake that we see here. We're only going to look at Abraham, but just to bring it back into perspective, that this guy Abraham, he was called of God, and he obeyed God. He believed God with all his heart, did what God told him to do, but he still screws up. And it brings comfort to me, because I've been called of God, and so have you. But I know that some of you still make mistakes and you still screw up. Not me, of course, I'm a pastor, but the rest of you. So it brings Abraham down here to believable terms. And I'll show you this in Genesis chapter 12, beginning of verse 10. He's brought him into the land, okay? But now there was a famine in the land. So Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it came about, when he came near to Egypt, that he said to Sarai, his wife, now catch this, "See now, I know that you are a beautiful woman. And it will come about, when the Egyptians see you, that they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, because they will let you live. Please, say that you are my sister." It's okay to sacrifice you, but I need to live. "Say that you are my sister, so that may go well with me because of you, and that I may live on account of you." This is this great name, Abraham. He's the greatest name in all biblical history, is this name, Abraham. "And it came about, when Abram came from Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. And Pharaoh's officials saw her and praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. Therefore he treated Abram well for her sake, and gave him sheep and oxen and donkeys, and male and female servants and female donkeys and camels." Turning out all right. He just sells his wife. "But the Lord struck Pharaoh and the house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abraham's wife. Then Pharaoh called Abram and said, 'What is this you've done to me? Why did you not tell me she was your sister? Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister? So I took her for my wife. And then here is your wife. Take her and go.' And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they escorted him away with his wife and all that belonged to him." God protects him in spite of this. But this is the promise to Abraham. It's going to be through his descendants. That whole thing is compromised. What if somebody slept with Abraham's wife and she gets pregnant by somebody down there in Egypt? So it was a terrible risk that he was doing, but God blesses this guy in spite of himself. I'm comforted by that, believe me. But let's move on. Let's go to this covenant that God makes with this man, Abraham, okay? I call it a unilateral covenant. There are all kinds of covenants that were in this ancient Near East at this time. There was a salt covenant. You're making a bargain. Covenant is a deal. You're making a deal. You're striking a bargain. There was a thing called a salt covenant. You take a pinch of salt out of your bag. Everybody carries around salt because they live in the desert. You take a pinch of your salt and you put it in his bag, and you take a pinch of his salt and you put it in your bag. That's the deal. And you may strike a bargain. There was a covenant or a bargain called a sandal covenant. I give you one of my sandals, you give me one of yours, and we strike a bargain. There was also a thing called a blood covenant, and this was much more binding. And you would take animals and you would separate them, and then both partners, you'd hold hands and you'd walk through the pieces of those animals, called a blood covenant. You break that covenant, you shed blood. It's a very binding thing, and it's a very serious deal. Both parties walk through these pieces. Let's take a look at it here. Genesis chapter 15. Chapter 15, let's begin in verse 7. "And he said to him, 'I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it.' And he said, 'O Lord God, how may I know that I shall possess it?' So he said to him, 'Bring me a three-year-old heifer, 3-year-old female goat, 3-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon.' Then he brought all these to them and cut them in two and laid each opposite the other. But he didn't cut the birds. And the birds of prey came down upon the carcasses, and Abram drove them away. Now, when the sun was going down," so you see that the pieces are separated, and then typically both parties walk through those pieces, okay? "Now, when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. And God said to Abram, 'Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and be oppressed 400 years. That's when they go down to Egypt and they're in slavery for 400 years. We'll look at that in a minute. "But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. And as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you shall be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. That is the land that he's going to give them when they move into that land. The people, they're terrible, sinful people. But he said it just hasn't come full circle yet. They haven't become as evil as they're going to be. I mean, they worshipped all kinds of false gods. They sacrificed their children to the gods. It was a desperately evil place. And God is going to dispossess them and give it to Abraham's descendants. And it came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. Notice who goes through the pieces? Only God. This is a unilateral covenant. This is depending upon God that this covenant is kept. It's not depending upon Abraham. There will be times when faith is a factor. There will be blessings. There will be things in the land that they will possess because they're believing. And then those that don't believe, they're booted out. They're left. Bad things happen. We're going to see that in the book of Judges. And just cycle through. But this depends upon the word of God. He made a promise, a unilateral covenant. This covenant cannot be broken because only God goes through it. Now, I was going to go into these judgments of Sodom and Gomorrah, but we know that God judges, and I'm going to just skip it and go to the next guy, Jacob. Now, I've skipped over Isaac. There's not much said in Genesis about Isaac. He's a well digger, and people kept coming and filling up Isaac's well, so we go dig another one. Those kind of things happen with Isaac. But then Isaac has a son, and his son is Jacob. Now, Isaac made the same mistake with his wife that Abraham did. I don't want to go into it. It's just too bad. So here we come to the next son, Jacob. And I want you in Genesis chapter 25. Now, most of this stuff, most of these stories, I think most of you had heard at one time or another, but it's just a little bit of refreshment. The name Jacob means basically a con man, a trickster. He's a deceiver. He's got a hold of his brother's heel when he's born, but that's what his name means. And I just call him Jacob the con man. He's not a nice guy. I mean, he's deceptive from day one. It is Jacob the deceiver, the con man, okay? But God's going to use him because this Jacob believes in the stuff of God. Genesis chapter 25, verse 23. This is the birth. Genesis chapter 25, verse 23. And the Lord said to her, this is to Rebekah, Jacob's mother, wife of Isaac. And the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples shall be separated from your body. And one people shall be stronger than the other. And the older shall serve the younger. That is totally out of order. Always the firstborn is the one who gets the double blessing, and he is served by the youngers. This one is a twist. And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. And afterwards his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. Let me read on. And when the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter. Already he's named trickster, con man. And now we're going to see how that even develops. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter and a man of the field, and Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. Now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Here is part of the problem. This loving one kid better than you love another one. I tell you, it is a disaster. Let me just give you a warning. If you have more than one kid, Renee, don't love that Miranda more than that other one.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Because it brings about bad stuff. We'll see it also with Joseph. And when Jacob had cooked stew, Esau came in from the field, and he was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please, let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished." Therefore his name was called Edom, which means red. But Jacob said, "First, sell me your birthright." Now remember that Esau is the firstborn, so he gets this double blessing. He gets the birthright, right? He gets all the inheritance, or most of it. But he says, "Sell me your birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I'm about to die, so what use is this birthright to me?" And Jacob said, "First, swear to me." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob, the con man, trickster, deceiver. And then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate, drank, rose up, and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. So we're getting an introduction to these boys that inherit this promise. They're anything but ideal and perfect, but they're human. But they believe God, and Jacob wants that birthright. It was actually prophesied that he'd get it, even to his mother when he was born. But he does this, and he gets it. Furthermore, later on, he tricks his own father, because his father couldn't see anymore, and his father Isaac was going to go ahead and bless Esau. And his mother saw this stuff, and they connived, and they Jacob dresses up like Esau and puts lamb skins on him, so his father feels him and says, "Well, that's my hairy son and not my smooth son." Crazy deal. But in any case, he just gets his birthright, and he gets the blessing as part of this promise. Now, I want you to jump ahead to chapter 28. He leaves then. I mean, Esau's going to kill him if nothing happened after he tricked his father. So he leaves. He goes over into his in-law's place to find a wife. And while he's on his way over there, he has this dream. Drop down to Genesis chapter 28, verse 10. "Then Jacob departed from Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place and spent the night there, because the sun had set, and he took one of the stones of that place, set it under his head, and lay down in that place. And he had a dream. And behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, 'I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. And your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth. You shall spread out to the west, the east, the north, and the south. And in you and your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed.'" And he names that place Bethel, the house of God. And I've got a verse up here, John 1:51, that refers specifically to this verse. He sees this ladder up to heaven and the angels of God ascending and descending on it. Jesus takes that and he says, "You will see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." Jesus is that ladder to heaven. He is the doorway. Remember in John chapter 14, he is called the way, the truth, and the life. Elsewhere, he's called the door. And it all comes back to this, because Jesus is that pathway to heaven. But it comes back to that promise. Now, later on, Jacob, let's go to it. Genesis chapter 32. Because we hear about the nation Israel. We don't hear about the nation Jacob, or the 12 sons of Jacob. We hear the 12 tribes of Israel. So how does this come about? Genesis chapter 32. Let's look and see what happens with Jacob and this angel of the Lord who is God. Genesis chapter 32, verse 24. This is when he's got himself a wife and he's coming back into the land again, okay? "And Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. And when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh, so the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Then he said, 'Let go, for the dawn is breaking.' But he said, 'I will not let you go unless you bless me.' And he said to him, 'What is your name?' And he said to him, 'Jacob.'" And we know what Jacob means. It means con man, trickster, shyster, supplanter, whatever. "And he said, 'Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven, you have wrestled with God and with men and have prevailed.'" So he changes his name from Jacob to Israel. Israel means basically he wrestles with God And he wrestled with the things of God all his life. I look at, I don't know about your life, but I rather expect it's not a whole lot different than my life, and I wrestle with the things of God. But it is a marvelous wrestling match. It is the best thing you could ever do. Challenge God. Question God. Get mad at God. He can handle all that stuff, but come to God with your stuff. Just like this guy comes to God. Because there is great blessing in that, and it's great lessons to be learned. But in any case, we talk about the 12 sons of Jacob. They are the 12 tribes of Israel. They're his sons. The second to the youngest of those is Joseph. We're not going to take a look. I'm not going to spend time looking up the scriptures on Joseph. But Joseph was this special son. He makes a special coat for Joseph. You know the many-colored coat that Joseph has? He singles him out. He loves Joseph and his little brother Benjamin better than the other boys. He's got 12 sons. You can't just fold and fondle over one of them. You got to love them all. But he doesn't. And so Joseph is picked on by his brothers. And his brothers finally said, well, let's kill this guy. Well, he said, we can make some money off him, so let's just throw him in a ditch with some blood on that fancy coat that his father gave him and sell him. So they sold him, and he goes down into Egypt. But God uses that to bless the nation Israel, because Joseph came up to be number two man in all of Egypt behind the Pharaoh himself. And God blessed them, and then they were able to house the Israelites, great blessings on them. They gave them land, and they existed, and they had food, and they had the number two guy in the whole nation looking after them with Joseph. But pretty soon, the Pharaohs that came along, they forgot about Joseph. They didn't know Joseph, and pretty soon they put the nation into slavery. So they were slaves in Egypt because they forgot about this guy, Joseph. And there were so many of them that the Egyptians feared for them, so they made slaves of them. Then we see that they came out of that slavery. We see the Passover given to them. We see the ten plagues of Egypt with Moses and his brother. And we saw the river, all the waters turned to blood. And then finally was the Passover, the firstborn children of each of everybody died unless they had the blood over the door of doorposts of the house. And then they let him out, and they came up to the Red Sea. God parted the Red Sea, and they go into the land. They're in the land for 40 years. They wouldn't have had to been that long, but they disobeyed God. In spite of all God does for them, they disobey, and they're sinful, and he makes them wander for 40 years. But then they go into the land, and we see this guy, Joshua, come to the leadership, go up to this city of Jericho, which has got, you know, 30-foot high walls and 16 feet thick, and this nation of Israel is supposed to take this city of Jericho, and God says, I'll give it to you. All you got to do is march around it for 7 days, once a day, and then on the seventh day, march around it 7 times, blow your trumpets, and the walls are going to fall down. And they did. And they fell down in such a way that you go to Jericho now, and these were huge walls. You can find no remnant of that wall. You go to any other city in Israel and find cities and remains, and you'll find the walls, you'll find stones. In many cases, they take the old stones, they put them right back up and build the same wall back up again because the stones are all there. There is nothing in Jericho. God pulverized those walls so that Israel went straight in and defeated the enemy. God is so powerful. He is the same powerful God that lives in us. And I'm not saying that the walls are going to fall down or your enemies are going to die at your feet, and it's a good thing because there are so many people that if I had that kind of power, it would not be good. It would not be good. But I don't have that kind of power. But God is so powerful in us, and he does powerful things in teaching us and providing for us and training us as his children. It is that same powerful God. Then we come around to the judges. And with the judges, a judge was a local ruler. They didn't have a king yet. They had local rulers, and they called them judges. And there would be a good judge, a faithful judge, and he'd believe in God, and everything would go well. Then the next judge would be just a loser and be worshiping other gods, and it would be just disasters. And so this cycles back and forth over and over and over. Gideon was one of those judges. Samson was one of those judges. The last of the judges was Samuel, and he was also a prophet. And it was Samuel that anointed Saul as king, because the Israelites said, we want a king. Well, God said, tell them, I'm your king. Samuel says, God is your king. You don't need a king. We want a king. We want a king. Everybody around us, all the other nations have a king. We want a king too. So Samuel goes to God, and God says, go ahead, give him a king. So he anoints this guy, Saul, as king. Saul was not a real faithful guy, and he screws up, and he consults witches and mediums, and he gets in all kinds of trouble, and God tears the throne away from him, and then he anoints David. And after David comes Solomon, his son. And Solomon was a great king, unbelievable wealth in the nation at this time. But unbelievable number of wives also Solomon had. Eventually that got him into trouble, and his son takes over after Solomon, and he was not a real smart guy, and pretty soon the nation divides. It divides into 10 tribes and 2 tribes. The bottom 2, the southern 2, were Judah and Benjamin, and the northern 10 tribes were Israel. So then it was divided, and you can see Israel to the north, Judah to the south, and they were called that way for some time. And then they eventually go into captivity because they had some pretty kings that weren't so good. Here's a little bit of an outline. We see the call of Abraham clear down here. Then we come up to the Exodus with Moses out of Egypt. And then they enter Canaan, the period of the judges, up and down and up and down. And then Saul is king, David's king, Solomon is king. And then the kingdom divides, 10 and 2. And then eventually they're taken into captivity by either the Assyrians and then eventually by the Babylonians. So then this is the time of the prophets. And the prophets are speaking basically judgments upon Israel and Judah. Both, they were singled out. Israel to the north never had a decent king for all this time. Never had one good one. None of them were faithful. None of them were believers in God. The south 2 tribes did have some good kings. But eventually they too were taken into captivity. And then A.D. 70... the Roman Empire, there's like 400 years of silence then after the prophets. And then in A.D. 70, Titus comes along, Roman Empire, and destroys Israel, destroys Jerusalem. From that point on, there was no Israel. There was no Israel for thousands of years now. This is from 70 A.D. till clear up to 1948, there was no Israel. Now, this influences writers of Scripture. It influences the people that write about what's Israel and the promises made to Israel. Well, there isn't any Israel. So these theologians, they look around and say, well, the church must be Israel. The church has replaced Israel because there isn't any Israel. It was destroyed in 70 AD. Then we come up to the Holocaust, relatively modern terms now. I don't know when they were starting to be thrown into concentration camps in World War II. I know that Hitler invaded Poland in 1939, and I don't know where in there, but they were in concentration camps, and 6 million Jews were murdered until 1945. Then they come into the land, and I call it a miracle of the providence of God. There was no Israel. There were all these promises made to Israel. There's a book of Revelation that refers to the nation Israel. But there isn't any Israel. So what are they going to do? All the writers just said, well, I guess it's symbolic stuff, and I guess the church has replaced it. But let me jump now to the future of Israel. I would argue that the Old Testament new promises reveal that they still are valid. So now I want you in the book of Ezekiel. Open it up in the middle, and in the middle, move to the right. And if you find yourself in the minor prophets, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, you've got to come back to the left. If you find yourself in the New Testament, you've got to come back past the minor prophets till you get to Ezekiel. And I want you in Ezekiel 37, which I read before. If you're back in Isaiah, or you're in the Psalms or Proverbs, you've got to come back to the right to get to Ezekiel, Ezekiel chapter 37. And if you're still thumbing around somewhere around the book of Revelation, yeah, you know the drill. Ezekiel. So we'll look at some future stuff. And now this first part is this dry bones thing, that he's telling Ezekiel, these dry bones, this is Israel. There's nothing but bones with Israel. But God's going to put flesh on them, and he's going to get life to them. And this is going to happen to the nation of Israel. So then I want to come down then to Israel chapter 37 and in verse 24. And back up even to verse 23. And they will no longer defile themselves with their idols or with their detestable things or with any of their transgressions, but I will deliver them from all their dwelling places in which they have sinned, and I will cleanse them. And they will be my people, and I will be their God. He's referring to Israel. And my servant David will be king over them, and they will all have one shepherd. And they will walk in my ordinances and keep my statutes and observe them. This is speaking of the nation Israel. Verse 25, they will live on the land which I gave to Jacob and Isaac and Abraham, to Jacob my servant, in which your fathers lived. And they will live on it, they and their sons' sons forever. And David my servant will be their prince forever. So David will have been resurrected, and maybe it's the actual King David who sits on the throne then, or maybe it's symbolic of the ideal David or the type of David who is Christ. That could be. But in any case, there's going to be a kingdom and there's going to be a king. Verse 26, I will make a covenant of peace with them. It will be an everlasting covenant with them. I will place them, multiply them, set my sanctuary in their midst forever. My dwelling place and also will be with them, and I will be their God, they will be my people, and the nations will know that I am the Lord who sanctifies Israel, and my sanctuary is in their midst forever. That has not happened. This has not happened for Israel. This prophecy was given after the old temple was destroyed. There's no temple there now, but there will be a temple. And there will be all these blessings, and there will be a kingdom with the nation Israel. It hasn't yet been fulfilled. Okay? Now let me look at another key passage, which is actually in the book of Romans, chapter 11. You can just look up here if you want to. Romans 11, 25. 9, 10, and 11 of Romans is all talking about Israel in the midst of all the church stuff. Paul wrote it all. Verse 25, for I want you, brethren, I do not want you to be uninformed of this mystery, so that you will not be wise in your own estimation, that a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. This is the age of the Gentiles now. We are all the Gentiles. This is called the church age. God is dealing with the Gentiles. Notice there is a distinction between Israel and the Gentiles. The Gentiles haven't replaced them. He's still talking about Israel. He's still talking about Gentiles. And then he goes on to say, and so all Israel will be saved. He's not talking about the church. He's distinguished between the church and Israel. So all Israel will be saved, just as it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion, he will remove ungodliness from Jacob. Who's Jacob? Israel. Remember, his name was changed from Jacob to Israel. This is the covenant with them when I take away their sins. So God is dealing, will deal with the nation Israel again, for the gifts of calling of God are irrevocable. He's made promises to Israel that are irrevocable. Then we come to the rapture of the church. Well, this is in 1 Thessalonians 4. Don't turn to it. But it's talking about the church being caught up. The word rapture comes from the Latin word, which means to be caught up. That's where we get the name rapture. The church is caught up to be with the Lord in the air. There's no other prophecy that has to be fulfilled before that time. We could be caught up today. It could happen today. But the church, all believers in Christ, are going to be literally lifted up. Our bodies are going to be reconnected with our spirits if we have died. He comforts people because the people were saying to Paul, well, what's happened to the people that we know that have believed but have already died? Jesus hasn't returned yet. He said, don't sweat it. They're going to be coming back first. They're going to be reunited with that dead body. Even if it's been burned up, it's probably rotted to nothing but ashes or worms. It's going to be reunited with your spirit, and we'll go to be with the Lord forever. We won't come back until the kingdom. We'll be there for 7 years. Now, that's the rapture of the church. Church age, then the tribulation. Let me skip that chart. The book of Revelation. We'll get over this part quickly, okay? Revelation chapter 1. Easy to find the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 1 gives an outline of the rest of the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 1, verse, what do we want? 17. John, the apostle writer, the writer that wrote the Gospel of John, wrote 1st, 2nd, 3rd John. He also wrote the book of Revelation. He has just seen Jesus amongst the lampstands. Jesus has his face like the sun, eyes like a flame of fire, his hair is white like wool, sound of many waters, stars in his right hand. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as a dead man. And he laid his right hand on me, saying, "Don't be afraid, I am the first and the last." He is Jesus, God in the flesh. "The living one, and I was dead, and behold, I'm alive forevermore. I have the keys of death and Hades. Write, therefore, the things which you have seen." That's what he just saw of Jesus. "And the things which are." That's going to be chapters 3 and 4 of the seven churches. That's the things with are, the church age. "And the things which shall take place after these things." Jump over to chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 1. "After these things I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the first voice which I heard, the sound of a trumpet speaking with me, said, 'Come up here, and I will show you what must take place after these things.'" It's future. The book of Revelation. All the book of Revelation is future. Chapter 7, don't go to it, but it deals with the 144,000, which, I'm sorry, Jehovah's Witnesses, they aren't you, they are Israel. And he goes through, makes a point of 12 tribes from the 12,000 from the tribe of Reuben, 12,000 from the time of from the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000, and he goes through 144,000 Jews, and they come to faith. So he's dealing with Israel, and then chapter 20 deals with the kingdom, a 1,000-year reign. We will be with Israel in that 1,000-year reign. That's all future. Now, There are some great men of God that have written Revelation commentaries. And so many of them were written before 1948. And they wrote of the book of Revelation, and they say, well, it has to be either symbolic or it has to be historic. I mean, it talks about the beast, talks about the Antichrist. Well, it must be somebody who has already lived, because there is no Israel. So the book of Revelation can't be future. It has to have already occurred. I sympathize with that mentality. If I was here, there was no Israel, Israel's mentioned in the Bible, I'd say, well, I don't know, there isn't any Israel. Church must be the Israel. So they don't take Revelation as futuristic. But since 1948, things have changed, because they went to war in 1947 and they were given their own independent status as a nation by the UN in 1948. So we have a nation, Israel. What have I said about it? There's now an Israel. After 2,000 years nearly, there hasn't been an Israel, but now there is. And I'm not saying that this nation Israel has all come to faith, that they're all believers, because they're not. In fact, they're not even very Orthodox Jews. 80% of them probably don't even go to synagogue. They aren't even observant. Only about 20% of them are good Orthodox Jews. But they're in the land. Is that prophesied in the Bible, that the nation Israel will appear suddenly in 1948? No. Is what they do prophetic today? No. Is everything that Israel does, is everything right? No, not necessarily. They're a nation like every other nation. They make mistakes, they do dumb things, they make good decisions, they make bad ones. But the point is, they exist. And I argue they exist by divine right. God promised them that land. And eventually, and I think miraculously, after 2,000 years and separated, you know, to all over the world they were. But every nation where the Jews were, they eventually booed them out, particularly around World War II. And then they had nowhere to go, but they went back into the land. And they have cultivated it. Prior to that, it was nothing but desert in the south and swamps in the north. They did nothing to make it any better, the people that were in the land. All they were goat herders. Israel comes back, and they have a irrigation system that is world class, that other nations of the world learn from. And they have grown things in the deserts in the south. They drained the swamps in the north. They have beautiful orchards there. They have brought back the land. They are an amazing people in my estimation. But God gave them that land. And in spite of what people say, even in Washington, that they don't belong there, they do. And I think they treat kindly as well as they can to the other people in the land. In Gaza, the people in Gaza hate them, and they'll shoot rockets at them periodically, and then Israel retaliates. They don't allow. Israel doesn't do everything right, but they certainly have a right to defend themselves against all of the nations that surrounded them. They would be surrounded on four sides if it weren't for the Mediterranean Sea, and all of those people hate them, and they'd all like to destroy them, but they can't. They've had wars, and they cannot destroy them. And I believe that God is preserving them because God will convert them. There will become a time during that tribulation period, we aren't even going to be here, and God is going to deal with Israel and bring them, and they will realize that Jesus of Nazareth, the Son of God, is their Messiah and their King. And they will come as a whole, as a nation. Israel is still in view in the plan of God. These communion elements remind us of the plan of God. They represent His plan, and they represent to us that He will return. We're not abandoned here. He will never leave us nor forsake us, even while we were on this planet, and He will come back and establish a kingdom upon this earth. When we take these elements, and as Paul wrote about it in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and it was looking back even to the Last Supper that the disciples, the boys, had with Jesus. He says, you take these elements and it reminds us of Christ's death until He returns. So even here involves the eventual perfect plan of God. Could I have the men come up and help me with these elements?